Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Florida, oranges are an iconic cash crop. But the Sunshine State's $10 billion citrus industry is in crisis. An insidious disease is decimating trees. There is foreign competition, less of a thirst for OJ. And that's before Hurricane Irma made landfall. This hour on Point, Florida's reeling citrus industry. You can join us on air or online. Are you seeing sticker shock at the grocery store? Are oranges still a staple in your household? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the crisis in the chocolate industry. But first, the big squeeze on Florida citrus. Joining me from New York City is Julie Wernauer, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who covers emerging markets and soft commodities. You can link to her story, Why Your Orange Juice Might Be From Brazil. Florida's trees are dying. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Julie Wernauer, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
So what exactly is happening to the citrus trees in Florida?
Well, unfortunately, for over a decade now, they've been struggling with this disease. It's called citrus greening. And if you can kind of imagine a tree as having a sort of vascular system, essentially what it does is it clogs the arteries of the tree and makes it difficult for water and nutrients to reach the fruit. And what ends up happening is that the fruit sort of gets malformed and drops to the ground before it's ripe. And therefore, you know, the oranges are useless to the growers.
And the carrier of this disease that causes the citrus greening is so small you can mistake it for a speck of pollen, right? I mean, it's little.
It's very little. I was down in Florida's orange groves this summer, and I said, you know, I want to see this psyllid that everyone, you know, says is causing this devastation. And it almost looks like a speck of dust. It's so small, and it just gets carried around the groves on just a light breeze and spreads everywhere. Mm.
So orange juice is big business, as we know, in Florida, is the epicenter. You write in your piece in the Wall Street Journal, citrus greening is pushing Florida's orange juice industry toward the brink of collapse. Talk about the economic impact of the Asian citrus psyllid, as it's called.
Yeah, this is a disease that has dropped jobs in the citrus industry, revenue in the citrus industry, just in the past 3 years alone by a third. It sort of sped up as it spread around the state, and now it's in a situation where it's actually present in nearly 100% of groves there. It used to be that the citrus growers would actually send in leaves to laboratories to get tested to see if they had the disease. And at this point, they don't even bother anymore because it's just everywhere. And so it's hard to overstate the impact on the industry.
And as far as production, give us the numbers. How many boxes now compared to a few years ago?
Well, this year, we were supposed to produce, according to Elizabeth Steger, she's this woman who counts all the oranges in Florida, about 75.5 million boxes. That's about 90 pounds of fruit in a box. And that would have been actually a little bit of an increase, but we had been down to the lowest output since 1964, and then Irma hit. And This what we're hearing across the state is that at least 50% of oranges dropped. It came at just the perfect time to just shake the fruit that was left from the trees. And so if you look at that number and you drop it by 50%, we're talking about levels we haven't seen since the 1940s.
Mm. Here's Lee Jones. He's the general manager of Gardenia Florida Citrus. He told the agriculture news site The Packer that after years of dealing with this disease, citrus greening, he was finally optimistic about crop yields until Irma hit, and that carved a path of destruction through Florida.
We've been struggling with greening disease. This year, we're actually looking at, you know, 30% up. And so we were really looking forward to this year being our first year of actually getting close to breaking even. And then Irma's hit and just put a big time hurting on us.
And here's Jean McAvoy, a regional vegetable extension agent with the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. He says Florida's industry, the citrus industry, will continue to feel the effects of not only citrus greening, but of Irma for months.
As the trees start to recover, they still have some fruit left in them, but they have physical damage. So, for instance, this tree has a few pieces of fruit left in it that have obviously dehydrated, and the stem has given up. And so we'll continue to see fruit fall for the next few months until we get to harvest.
So, Julie, we're now, we have Asian citrus psyllid that produces the citrus greening, and then Hurricane Irma. I mean, this is like a perfect storm, no?
That's right. I mean, this is an industry that's, you know, used to dealing with sort of catastrophic freezes and the occasional hurricane, you know, but these are, for the most part, you know, one-off events that, you know, eventually the industry is able to recover. Unfortunately, with greening on top of that, you already have citrus growers who have been struggling since 2005 to try to just keep their trees alive. And so when something like Irma hits, if they're on the edge of deciding, should I just abandon this grove and this industry altogether or not, it can lean that way.
And what about prices? What does this mean for, you know, a carton of OJ at the grocery store?
Well, prices have definitely gone up. We are looking at, not from concentrate orange juice, has hit $7.75 a gallon, and it's up about 50% since this whole situation took off. The oranges themselves in Florida have hit all-time highs just this year, and so what's happened is a lot of these orange juice producers have started to import orange juice from Brazil, trying to get enough oranges and cut down the costs for consumers.
Let me bring in a grower from Florida. Joining me now from Fort Pierce, Brand Sherrard. He's production manager at Blue Goose Growers, also the vice president of the Florida Farm Bureau Federation. Brandt, how great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here.
So tell me how citrus greening has affected your business.
Well, as Julie mentioned before, it's certainly the most prolific disease we've faced in my career, which is dating back to the early 80s. And it's a very difficult disease to deal with because it's carried by a vector that's very prolific and very difficult to control. And now, as Julie mentioned also, we've got 100% infection across the state and all the commercial producing areas.
So when did you first know you had a problem in your groves?
Well, I guess after the hurricanes of 2004 and 5 and 6, we were dealing with canker, which was spread across the state for the first time in a long time. And the psyllid was detected down in South Florida in some of the inspections down there. And very quickly it spread across the state. I'd say most growers were starting to see the effects, or at least some infection, as early as 2005, but ramped up quite a bit in a couple of years after that.
Brandt, tell us what your trees look like. Describe them for us. Take us into the grove and describe what's happening.
Well, it depends on the variety somewhat. We're on the East Coast where I am, we're primarily grapefruit groves with some juice orange groves in this production area. And the grapefruit seem to be not tolerating the disease very well at all, maybe the worst of any of the varieties. So we've gone from a very lush, very dense canopy to somewhat thin, necrotic-looking canopy that in production, where we used to see grapefruit groves in the neighborhood of anywhere between, depending on the age and the health of the grove, maybe between 300 and 500 boxes, maybe even 600 boxes to the acre. It's hard to find a grove producing more than maybe a couple hundred boxes an acre now. Mm.
And it's so insidious because it takes so long to detect, right? I mean, it can take root in your grove and you wouldn't know it for years.
Well, that was the early problem that we really didn't know what we were dealing with until we already had it, because of the bacteria spreads. It can actually stay latent in the tree before it expresses any symptoms that you can physically see.
Is there
spread a lot faster than people were thinking.
Yeah. Is there a difference between how this is affecting large commercial citrus growers versus small family farms?
I would say probably so. I mean, it's all relative based on, you know, everybody's fighting the same problems, but the established, highly capitalized companies that are able to withstand the increased expense of operations and the reduced yields and reduced revenues, and maybe more vertically integrated within the industry, maybe a packing facility and sales organization associated with the groves themselves, have a better opportunity to work on the thinner margins that are out there than maybe a small grower who's one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Have you all banded together down there, Brent? You tried to help each other? Any collaboration going on among the growers?
Oh, absolutely. This is an all-in situation. There are people from every aspect of the industry working on this. We've got a tremendous amount of research being done. And if anybody learns anything, they're gladly the first one to try to share it.
And how are your revenues? Have you had to lay off workers? How's your bottom line, Brent?
Bottom lines are definitely very, very thin. There probably is a very low percentage of the groves in Florida right now that are actually in the black. It's our goal to try to go out and try to match costs with what our projected revenues will be with reduced production. Then you have, as Julie mentioned earlier, the storm, Irma, that came through here that just kind of wiped out this year's revenue. It just makes it very difficult.
Brent Sherrard, we wish you the best, and take care down there. Thanks very much for taking some time away from the groves to speak with us.
Surely welcome.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. They follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/onpoint. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the crisis in Florida's citrus industry this hour, and you can join the conversation. Do you worry about genetic modification of orange trees in order to combat citrus greening? Could that lead to new or unforeseen problems? I'm speaking this hour with Julie Wernauer. She has a big story about all of this in the Wall Street Journal. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. I want to play this Anita Bryant ad from the early 1970s, shows how iconic this industry has been throughout time when she served as a spokesperson for the Florida Citrus Commission.
A day without orange juice is like a day without sunshine. Orange juice, serve it generously from the Florida sunshine tree.
Sadly, those trees not so sunny these days. Here's Robert Bowden, the executive director of Lou Gardens in Orlando. He told the Orlando Sentinel in 2015 that the gardens produced 1,500 pounds of oranges, grapefruits, lemons, limes, and other fruit just a few years ago. And now they are taking those trees out because of the disease and trying to adapt.
It looks as though all of the trees that we have on property have been infected with the citrus greening disease. We're working with local landscape architects, and we hope to revitalize that area and include a typical southern plant palette.
And here's Susan Halbert, an entomologist with the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Scientists. Here she is slicing open a piece of fruit that has been affected by citrus greening.
Cut it open. We'll see if it has the bitter flavor. That one's not very good. Yeah,
another one off center.
I like to get as many clues as I can. And one of the symptoms of citrus greening disease is that the fruit has a bitter off flavor.
So, Julie, we're now, it's not just that the fruit is malformed, it also doesn't taste the same.
That's right. And one of the ways that they can tell, it's interesting from that little anecdote there, is you sort of hold up the orange and it'll be a little off center. Your finger should be, you know, one on top of the other if you hold it up with two fingers. And if it's a little off center already, you know, it has greening, and it changes the taste, which is very, you know, sad for a Florida citrus.
And it's not just oranges. You know, I'm hearing here lemons and limes, and our farmer Brandt mentioned grapefruits as well.
Yes, grapefruit has been even more devastated for whatever reason. Like Brandt said, it doesn't seem to tolerate this disease at all. When I was driving around in the groves in Florida, you could easily cite where the grapefruit was. I mean, some of these trees have just become sticks, and there's really not much grapefruit output happening anymore.
Some Florida orange farmers are talking about genetically engineered orange trees now, which would be, of course, resistant to citrus greening, but that's really years away, and certainly before a lot of questions about genetically modified foods, which are widely used in corn and, of course, soybeans, but much less often in fruit. Tell us about this potential solution, I guess.
Yeah, this is a disease that when they try to test a new product or some kind of solution to it, they actually have to do it in real life. And so there's this secret tiny little orange grove in Florida that I visited that is growing what would be the first ever genetically engineered oranges. And the oranges themselves won't even start to come off these trees for a few years. So they're waiting to find out, will it work? And in the meantime, they're trying to sort of protect this grove. They're concerned about vandals. As you know, this is a time when a lot of consumers are questioning the use of genetically modified foods. And so they're concerned, you know, that in the meantime, they need to really protect the grove in case folks just, you know, show up to protest, any number of things.
Got a board full of calls here. Let's get to Jennifer in Lakeland, Florida. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I hear the, you know, flavor has changed because of the greening, but I've had a question for many, many years about the flavor of citrus, specifically our navel oranges, because in the 90s, they were big and juicy and easy to peel, and they smelled good. And here we are. I cannot get my son to eat an orange to save his life. He just will not do it because they're so bitter. And I'd heard that there were some issues with the crops. I've driven around the state, and it looks like the very trees themselves are stunted anymore compared to the way they were.
Stunted? You know, they just don't look the same to you, Jennifer.
They don't look the same. They mm-hmm. look smaller, shaggier, and they don't look healthy anymore. Mm-hmm. And somebody had told me a while back that there's a law in Florida that we have to send all of our best produce out. And I don't know if that's true or not, but they were trying to tell me that's why we have such stinky oranges. And I'm like, no, that mm-hmm. can't be it. They literally do not seem like the same fruit mm-hmm. anymore.
Jennifer, thank you very much for the call down there in Florida. Let's go to Tampa now. Bruce is on the line. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. My brother's been in the citrus industry for about 50 years, and we're riding around, we're noticing the trees, and he mentioned one thing, that they were experimenting on a tree that was more sturdy in the wintertime, that would handle the cold weather better. And I just wanted to find out, are you familiar with this? And do you think that would have an effect on it? It has to have some effect on the oranges if you're going to change the tree.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, okay, thank you very much for the call. Julie Wernow, what do you know about that?
Well, actually, yes. There's a lot of experimenting going on right now with various varieties. As you know, farmland really at this point is sort of the epicenter of technology and science, and there's a lot of that happening in citrus. I mean, I went to a number of laboratories where they're trying out different rootstock to see if they can find hardier varieties. Some of these farmers have discovered that for whatever reason, some varieties of trees seem to be doing better than others. They're not entirely sure why. And so there's any number of scientists right now who are working on this, in addition to folks in the industry themselves. And so I'm sure that what that gentleman was saying is likely one of the things that is being looked at.
Let me bring another voice in here from Lake Alfred, Florida. Michael Rogers, director of the Citrus Research and Education Education Center at the University of Florida, and then professor of entomology and nematology at the University of Florida. Full disclosure, some of the funding for this center comes from the citrus industry. Michael Rogers, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So tell us a little about the science, the history behind citrus greening. Where did it come from? When did we first notice it?
Okay, so citrus greening has been known for more than 100 years in Asian countries like China and India, but the disease never made its way into the U.S., into the Western Hemisphere, until 2005. And actually, in 2004, the disease was first detected in Brazil. And in the subsequent year, in 2005, we found citrus greening disease present in Florida. Prior to that, the Asian citrus psyllid, which is the insect that carries the bacterium which causes citrus greening disease, the psyllid was found in Florida in 1998. And so we had a period of time, about 7 years, from the time the psyllid was found until we found our first tree, citrus tree, infected with citrus greening disease.
And that's because it takes so long to present itself, right?
Yes, and that's one of the things that we've learned over time is that early on, when a psyllid feeds on the tree and puts that bacteria into the tree, it goes down to the root system below ground first, and it starts to take out or kill the root system of the tree. And so what happens over time is the disease symptoms that you see are a result of the root system not being able to move the nutrients and waters from the soil to the canopy. And so that's what makes the disease so hard to diagnose, is because it can often be confused with nutritional deficiencies.
Tell us about this so-called spinach gene that's being thought to work on this or be promising in some way.
Okay, so there's some work that's being done, and this is actually not a University of Florida project, but this is with Texas A&M University and a private company here in Florida. And the goal of that particular project is they were looking at plant defense genes taken from spinach that they would insert into citrus to see if that would actually convey resistance to the disease in citrus plants. And while I'm not directly involved in that research, the reports we hear back is that they're having a lot of success in terms of these trees being more resistant to the disease.
Success, but is it fast enough? I mean, it's a long process to determine if a tree has maintained resistance, as we've heard here, again, can take years.
Yes, anytime you're developing a new variety of a perennial crop, a long-lived tree, that process always takes a much longer time than something like a row crop like corn, wheat, or rice. And so, it is going to take a lot longer. But in the meantime, as these long-term solutions are being developed for the citrus industry, we have been making advances in more short-term solutions to help growers hang on until those long-term solutions are developed.
What are the short-term solutions?
Okay, so one of the first things that growers started doing in Florida was increasing their pesticide sprays to control the insect that carries the citrus greening pathogen.
Does that work, so, pesticides?
It bought time. There's nothing we have that's a silver bullet. And so this was really buying time for the industry, slowing down the rate of disease spread throughout the groves, and just buying additional years of life for those trees.
Okay, so we got pesticides. What else?
So the other thing, the real focus has been lately is trying to maintain the health of those infected trees. So if you think about a person who's in the hospital that's sick, the doctors are trying to give them what they need to recover or get better and let their body fight off the disease. Well, in the case of greening, what we're trying to do with growers, they're kind of like that doctor. They're going out and they're making sure that they're watering the trees properly. They're giving them the right nutrients they need to grow, just to give those trees a fighting chance to kind of hold on in the meantime. And as was mentioned earlier, we really felt that we had kind of turned a corner in the industry as far as the rate of fruit decline, yields we've had year over year, they've been declining. This year, we thought that because of these advances we've made in learning how to care for these sick trees, that our yields were going to stabilize. We had seen probably an all-time low, or at least for the past 40 years, a low last year in our fruit production. And this year, we were expecting to see at least a 10% or more increase in yields. And that's because of the practices that growers have been putting in place to maintain the health of these groves.
Trying to do what they can. Let's get David in here from Aiken, South Carolina. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I understand that there's a congressman in Florida that's trying to get a bill through to help the citrus growers. Why should we spend $200-300 million of federal money from all of the taxpayers in the country for an industry that doesn't even support 2% of the population as far as jobs and economic growth.
Mm-hmm. David, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Julie Wernauer, David talks about the Florida congressman, I think, Vern Buchanan, proposes the citrus industry bailout to help with citrus greening, these diseases that's killing the trees, and, of course, the damage that Irma's done. David says, why spend the money? Why should we bail out this industry?
Well, I do think that as we've talked about a little bit here, the research that's going into citrus greening, I mean, this isn't a disease that's going to go away or that is even just here in the United States. It's also present in Brazil, where we are, you know, if we wanted to, we could just get our juice at this point from Brazil and Mexico, which also grow juicing oranges. But in this, at the same token, eventually, you know, this is also going to present itself as a very large problem in those areas too. And so, what we're really talking about is the future of citrus.
Michael Rogers, talk about Brazil and how it's poised to take over this industry.
Well, Brazil is facing some of the same challenges we are. They've had this disease a little bit longer than we have. They do have some cheaper production costs than Florida does. They do have more acres of citrus planted. Keep in mind, we're talking about the country of Brazil versus the state of Florida. And so, our citrus industry is concentrated in a small part of the state of Florida, whereas in Brazil, they tend to spread out more across the country. But the problems they face in Brazil are the same that we face here in many ways. Just what will happen is when a grove becomes unproductive in Brazil, they may plow that grove under and plant sugarcane in its place. And somebody else will plant another grove and continue on. But long term, I really don't think Brazil is going to take over citrus production in Florida.
What do you think? Julie, what do you think? I mean, I can't imagine the U.S. government would want to cede its entire industry, citrus industry, to Brazil. How do you see this?
Well, I mean, that's what it sounds like, right? That they're trying to figure out a solution. I mean, this is a state that has, you know, the orange on its license plate. I mean, Florida is synonymous with orange juice. And, you know, this has been going on for quite some time. And what's been very devastating about this hurricane is that it also compromised, you know, potentially research that's been years in the making. There were folks trying everything from covering their groves with sort of a tent-like apparatus. It's called CUPS, Citrus Under Protective. Michael will know. To, you know, laboratories that were working on other solutions. And so this has, you know, gotten much, much worse as a result of this hurricane.
Let's get Brad in here from Clearwater, Florida. Hi, Brad. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hey, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment, really, that we're really going to need genetic research, genetically modified organisms when it comes to oranges. And I just would like for people to not be afraid of this technology. There's so much media out there to demonize it when, in fact, it could be the only thing to save oranges. And I grew up down here in Florida, and I've basically spent every day of the winters climbing up trees to get my lunch up until a few years ago. And I'm just really sad that we don't have oranges anymore. So.
Brad, thank you. Thanks very much. Let's get Bob in here from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Hilton Head Island. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Quick question would be, since this disease began over in Asia and has been there for many, many years, have we gone back there to find out what are they doing? What's the status there? Have we learned anything from their experience?
Good question, Bob. Thank you. Michael Rogers.
Yes, and that's a good question. We've had a number of our researchers actively working in China, in India, and these other areas, looking for solutions to the problem of citrus greening. Now, this disease has been over there for more than 100 years. It's limited production in Asia, so they've not been able to compete with Florida. But we have put more time and energy and money into finding solutions than has been done in the past. And things that are being looked at right now, there's a lot of, citrus originated in China. And so there's a lot of wild citrus varieties over there that are seem to be immune to this disease. And so right now we're looking at the genetics of those immune plants to develop solutions for the future.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Florida's citrus industry on its heels this hour, and you can join the conversation. Are you working on an innovative idea to save the orange trees? Growers in California and Texas, what do you hear in this conversation? You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Wall Street Journal reporter Julie Wernauer and University of Florida Citrus Research and Education Center Director Michael Rogers. Here's a 2015 television ad for an orange juice company that boasts its juice is produced entirely from fruit grown in the United States.
There's one national orange juice brand that can proudly claim to use only 100% American oranges. It's not Simply Orange, and it's not Tropicana. Only Florida's Natural never imports orange juice from overseas. Great taste, naturally.
And here is Ted White and his family. They've spent decades farming oranges in Central Florida. And last year, they closed the packing house, slashed labor costs to try to deal with this scourge.
Citrus screening is a huge challenge. And we felt like it would be better for us to downsize. It was a tough decision, but my parents live right there. It's easy for us to do it with my parents. I live at the back of the grove, and the stress level's just gone.
And here's Steve Johnson, a longtime citrus farmer with 600 acres in Central Florida. He told CBS News' David Begnaud last year he has no plans to walk away from the industry.
It's not a job and it's not a business. It's a way of life. I'm the fourth generation to be here, and to give that up would really hurt me.
I get the sense greening's not going to kill that.
No, it might kill the trees, but it's not going to kill our spirit.
A couple of farmers there. Michael Rogers, I have to ask you about that television ad, because the marketing component of all this is so interesting. We've grown up with, you know, Florida orange juice commercials touting 100% Florida oranges. Remember the ad where they put the straw into the orange, right? Oranges are on the license plate of the state. You got the Orange Bowl in Florida. Citrus is so ingrained into the Florida zeitgeist. How does this all affect the mindset of Florida, the mentality, the morale even, Michael?
Yeah, this definitely has an impact on people's morale right now. I mean, here we've been dealing with a disease for 12 years that's slowly chipped away at our crop, and growers are struggling to stay in business. We've made it through a lot of tough times over the decades past, but this disease challenge has been, greater than anything ever faced. And then to have Hurricane Irma come through, take what's going to be an already very low crop that people are struggling to make ends meet, knock half that fruit off the tree onto the ground, it's devastating for the industry. And so right now, we're really trying to recover and really reach out to the legislators to get assistance to help get this industry back on its feet.
Let's go to Trent in Rapid City, South Dakota. Hi, Trent. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. My comment, I guess, is just referring to the caller who called about why would the government help this form of agriculture. And my question is, why wouldn't they? They help all the other forms of agriculture there are. I mean, South Dakota, they have crop insurance. They give you money if you leave a field unplanted for the year. That ranchers get help if their cattle die or whatnot. So I guess my question would be, why wouldn't we want to help them?
Trent, thank you. Michael Rogers, earlier caller David, said, why spend the money? Why bail out this industry? Trent says, of course we should. How do you see it?
Yeah, well, the citrus industry, not only in Florida, but in across the U.S., is very important to our economy. But when we just look at Florida, for example, we have 45,000 jobs in the state of Florida tied directly to some aspect of the Florida citrus industry, and that has an economic impact on the state annually of about $10 billion, billion with a B. And so it's not a small player in our economy. I mean, we're number two behind tourism, of course, which dominates Florida's economy. But if we were to lose those jobs, that economic impact, it's going to have an effect not only just the small towns throughout Florida and families and a way of life, but it's going to ripple across the country in the economy. Mm-hmm. So it's not just it's what happens in Florida, but it will have an impact across the country.
Julie Wernauer, that really gets your attention. Talk about California and Texas. They grow oranges too. What's happening in orange groves out there?
Yeah, I mean, as we said, that this disease is also present in both those places, and there are scientists in both those places who are also working on a solution. The problem in Florida that's made it so widespread is that these groves are all very, very tightly packed together, and also the climate there in particular helps to allow this disease to spread more rapidly. And so when you have a situation where a grower abandons their grove and they're directly across the street from someone who's still working to try to, as we talked about, take care of these sick trees, it's almost impossible. One thing that we haven't really discussed here is that there's also this added factor of shifting tastes. Americans are really just not drinking as much orange juice as they were in 2005. And so that's compounding the problem. People want less sugar in their diets. They want things to be less processed. And so on top of the fact that this disease is here, that's another economic factor in play.
Interesting. Now let's go to Christine in Winnetoon, Nebraska. Hi, Christine. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I'm calling because I'm a Florida citrus fruit lover many years. And it's gotten to the point now where when I go to the grocery store, it's chili, Uruguay, I noticed, and just can't find Florida oranges anymore. I've always chose them before California oranges. Give a call out to Florida. Please give us your wonderful oranges somehow again.
Christine, thank you. Thanks very much. A lot of farmers down there like to hear that. Justin from Twitter writes, he's a native Floridian. He says, driving up the turnpike, I used to see lush groves in the 1990s. Now I see gnarled, leafless trunks, abandoned groves. Let's get Ellen in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Ellen. You're on. Ellen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
I'd like to know, and I hope your guest might have a point here, why the organically grown citrus industry has not been brought into the conversation, because I'd be willing to bet they have a much more hopeful story to share.
Okay, Ellen, do they? Julie Wernauer, do you think?
That's interesting that the caller brought that up. When I was down in Florida, I just happened to get in a conversation with a woman who her father was growing organic oranges. And while I did not get out to his groves, she claimed that he was having some success growing organic oranges in Florida. And it would be interesting to hear a little bit more from them on that front. I don't know if some of them are growing citrus, you know, far from some of these other groves or undercover or what is happening there. But I do know that this isn't a disease that isn't present in pretty much every single grove in Florida, regardless of whether it is organic.
Ellen, thanks very much for the call. Michael Rogers, is climate change a factor in citrus greening? Not necessarily the hurricane piece, but the actual disease.
Well, the way climate, there's very little changes in climate here in Florida that are going to impact this disease. When you look at Florida's climate in general, we're a subtropical environment. We have high amounts of rain, perfect temperatures. And so that's what makes citrus an ideal crop to grow here, because our conditions are great for citrus. But at the same time, every pest that comes into Florida is going to get established very well, you know, whether it be an insect or Burmese pythons in the Everglades, you know, things. Exotic pests and diseases seem to thrive here in the subtropical climate. So we have to take the good with the bad. I mean, it's the perfect ideal climate to grow citrus. Mm-hmm. We have the best tasting citrus in the world, our orange juice especially, if you compare it to other countries. But it comes at a cost, because of those environmental conditions that are great for growing citrus also facilitate those other pests coming in and getting established.
Last 20 seconds here. I know we have no crystal balls. Will the Florida orange industry return to its peak? Michael Rogers, what do you see?
Yes, the Florida industry is resilient. It's a tough time right now, but we're making great advances in the research, and we know that it will not be too much longer before there will be solutions available for growers to replant their groves.
Last word, Julie Wernauer, what do you think?
I think that it's a little too soon to tell. We have years before we're going to find out if some of these solutions work. And in the meantime, the big key is to keep the growers growing versus, you know, selling their land.
Julie Wernauer, Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for your piece. And Michael Rogers down there at University of Florida. Really great panel and interesting information. Thank you very much. In a moment, the chocolate industry in crisis. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Well, the plant that's the source of chocolate has a crisis of its own. Cacao has never recovered from a fungal epidemic that struck generations ago. All chocolate lovers know the price of their favorite confection keeps going up. Joining me now from San Jose, Costa Rica, is Miles Karp. He wrote about this for the New York Times in a piece called A Battle to Save the World's Favorite Treat, Chocolate. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Miles Karp, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
So tell us about cacao. What exactly is it?
Cacao is a tree that produces a pod, which looks sort of like a football, maybe something like a cross between a football and a pumpkin. And inside that are seeds, which get fermented, ground up, processed, and turned into chocolate.
So that's the process of turning the cacao into the chocolate. It's fermenting those interior seeds of the plant?
And the plant is in trouble right now. The trees are sickly around the world. There are a few different diseases that are threatening it. The most virulent one is frosty pod rot, which turns these pods into mummies, basically. It coats them with this white fungal rot. Then the pods just don't mature, and the plants die.
And what's the origin of that? What's the origin of the frosty pod rot? Do we know?
The origin, it's a fungus that seems to have evolved in South America. First reported in Colombia in the 19th century. It kind of stayed put for a really long time. It's been spreading quicker and quicker lately, probably because of human intervention. So this thing spreads naturally via wind, but humans can take infected plant material on an airplane. They can take the spores on their shoes. So as commerce and trade have increased in the developing world, so have opportunities for this fungus to spread.
So,
and that's why it's become a more pressing crisis lately.
I see. Would I get sick from eating frosty pod rot chocolate? I mean, would it get that far?
It wouldn't get that far. You wouldn't get chocolate from the trees. The issue is that the farmers won't be able to grow cacao anymore once their plantation gets infected.
I see. And so what does a diseased cacao plant look like compared to a healthy plant?
If it's an immature plant, it just won't mature. If it's more mature, if the pods are already sizable, it'll just get covered in this white fungal coating and it'll die. And then all the plants around it will also die. Depending on the conditions of the area, probably the farms nearby will also get infected and they'll all start getting covered in this fungal coating and dying.
And so what's being done to combat this in the laboratory, by governments, by industry?
By governments and industry, not enough. In the laboratory, well, also not enough. The most promising work being done is hybridizing new varieties of cacao that are disease resistant. Mostly done by one scientist, Wilbert Phillips Mora, in Costa Rica, working at an institution called CATIER. He's sort of the only guy who anticipated this crisis and started working before it became an emergency. He has this collection of 1,235 cacao varieties, which is an amazing resource for just preserving the genetic diversity of this plant. And he's been identifying naturally tolerant, naturally resistant varieties, performing the painstaking task of crossing them. And now he actually has frosty pod rot resistant cacao, which has actually been making a little bit of a foothold in Latin America.
Oh, interesting. So if supply is low, but demand keeps rising, seems like the perfect storm here. What does a chocolate shortage look like? And you say chocolate is worth more than people are paying for it, right?
Yeah, well, so are a lot of the things we eat. If we were willing to pay more, the farmers would have a better livelihood. A chocolate shortage would look, for consumers, like higher prices for the most part. It would be a much more pressing issue for the farmers, for the people who produce this treat that we love. You know, a little increase in price of a Hershey's bar for us might mean entire farming communities devastated somewhere in Latin America or perhaps Africa. So Frosty Podrod isn't in Africa yet.
Mm-hmm. So what's the future of the industry, of the cacao industry, Miles? You wrote that cacao already is not a terribly appealing form of food to producers. Seems like this is yet another reason to stay away if you're trying to farm it.
Right. Well, I hope that these hybrid varieties become disseminated. I hope that scientists like Dr. Phillips Moore gets more support. If that happens, a crisis like this can also be an opportunity to change things up, change up the way we do things. Chocolate is not a monoculture now, but it's almost. If we recognize that growing only a few varieties is putting our agriculture at risk, hopefully the farmers will adopt more varieties of cacao. We'll have more diverse varieties growing, which also means in the market we'll have more diverse flavors, more diverse price points. It's sort of like an opportunity to have what happened with craft beer happen with chocolate. And that's starting to happen a little bit in places like the U.S., where you can get a fancy chocolate bar that talks about the farm where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
That probably also means the farmers are making a better living. So I hope that's what will happen.
That's all good. All good news. Miles Karp, thanks for the update. We appreciate it. And you wrote the cacao industry piece in Costa Rica for the New York Times. You all can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Miles Karp, thank you.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners, and get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about late-night television, how it's turning from funny to serious. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.